Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 8th of September 2018, the fourth episode. Now, there's been lots of interruptions getting me getting momentum up and reading this through from cover to cover. Really, my objective is to do it in two episodes, so I'm a long way off it. And there's been great wind out here, and it's blowing this New Scientist around the place, and a little bird's done a poo on this article somewhere, so it's pretty disgusting. But here's the article: Lessons from Early Earth. Our deepest history could hold the key to the search for life on other planets, Kelly Oates reports. So that seems to be a given that people are really super concerned that there's life on other planets. Few discoveries could be bigger than detecting life on another planet. Whether it's a rocky ball or a giant cloud of gas, hot, cold, or somewhere in between, we aren't picky. So long as the world has life, we want to find it. So a declaration to get yourself going. For as long as we have searched, we have had one image in mind, Earth. It may seem like vanity, but our focus makes a certain amount of sense. After all, Earth is the only planet in the universe that we know for a fact supports life. Even if faraway exo-Earths don't have oceans, continents, rainforests, deserts, and polar caps, the long-standing assumption is that they will be still be familiar in certain ways. There will be water on the surface, oxygen in the air, possibly even vegetation on the land. But Earth hasn't always looked the way it does now. In the 4.5 billion years our planet has existed, or 4.6 as I remember, it's experienced some dramatic transformation: ice age, warming periods, times when the atmosphere was impossible to breathe, when large areas were deserts, or when lush tropical rainforests hugged the poles. Although the vast majority of this turbulent history, life has somehow clung on. If armed with the spotter's guide to worlds we inhabit today, we found exoplanets resembling those early Earths, we would even recognize them for what were. Maybe not. We know how to seek comparatively advanced signs of intelligent life, such as cacophonous radio transmissions and the bright lights of megacities. If a planet has a less sophisticated inhabitants, however, we must rely on identifying other signatures of life. That's why scientists are interested in finding the blind spots of our search for intelligent life have started a lot closer to home. They want to imagine how early Earth would look if seen from far outside the solar system. The first time we tried to study our planet from afar was the Galileo mission, launched in 1989. It was programmed to orbit twice around the Earth, using the planet's gravitational pull as a slingshot to power it on its way to its ultimate goal, Jupiter. The astronomer Carl Sagan suggested taking the opportunity to point our best alien-finding equipment at Earth itself. It found nothing, he reasoned. If it found nothing, he reasoned, that meant life elsewhere might also escape our attention. Galileo was the first of several probes to use their instruments in this way, and they confirmed that our technological civilization should be detectable by a distant, similarly advanced alien civilization. Were there no hints of technology to home in on? By far, the best life sign to latch on to is oxygen. Its abundance in our atmosphere, 21%, would be difficult to sustain without plants pumping it out constantly. Methane released by bacteria, as well as flatulent livestock, is a more ambiguous biosignature, given that a number of non-biological mechanisms can produce the gas. A bigger giveaway than either oxygen or methane on their own, however, is the presence of both. That's because the combination is combustible and releases energy when it reacts, forming carbon dioxide and water. Quote, even if these two gases are left on their own devices, they'll usually annihilate, says Richard Reinhardt of Georgia Institute of Technology. The fact that they both present a relatively high abundance suggests that they might be pumped into the atmosphere at very high rates, potentially by biology. Another reliable sign of life is light reflected by plants. Although a plant's vegetation absorbs most of visible wavelengths, with exceptions of green, that's why they're coloured green, bloody hell, it absorbs far less infrared light. The upshot is an abrupt jump known as the red edge in Earth's reflective spectrum, a phenomenon that would be hard to replicate without living organisms. Research for the high levels of oxygen, methane coexisting with oxygen, or a red edge would be a good way of picking up planets that look like Earth now. But Earth has been inhabited, not to mention inhabitable, for far longer than it has displayed any of these features. The earliest known life forms emerged about 4 billion years ago. Now we believe 4.2 billion years ago. When the planet's crust was cooling to form rocks of the beginnings of continents. At this time, known as the Archean, Earth's atmosphere would have been dominated by carbon dioxide produced by active volcanoes. In this hostile environment, primitive microbes emerged. Here we're coming to our poo-covered page. Ugh. I've got nothing against the bird, it's just, yeah, I had to lay a turd on my page. Okay. That made methane and oxygen levels were at an all-time low. This is fortunate. If they had been any higher, life as we know it might not have emerged at all. Quote, oxygen poisons some of the prebiotic chemistry that we think accumulated in the origin of life on Earth. Stephanie Olson of the University of California, Riverside. A billion or so years later, the planet entered a time called the Proterozoic photosynthesis had already been well underway, but it was at this time the ability to convert carbon dioxide into oxygen had lasting consequences for the planet. For the first time, oxygen, carbon dioxide and methane coexisted in the atmosphere, leading to the accelerated evolution of multicellular life. During this time, there were two snowball Earth events when the entire planet was covered with ice. The trigger may have been something as trivial as a brief drop in global temperatures allowing the polar ice caps to expand. This reflected more sunlight, reducing temperatures even more in a feedback loop that eventually froze the whole planet. The trouble is, we don't know how freezing would have affected the chance of spotting life from afar. Quote, the composition of the atmosphere during the snowball Earth events is actually not terribly well known, said Reinhardt. I suppose he's been introduced. The Proterozoic defining feature, however, was a billion year period of apparent stability from 1.8 billion years ago to 800 million years ago, after a frenzy emergence. So that's a billion years. 1.8 to 8 billion years ago, 80 billion years, 800 billion years ago, 800 million years ago. After the frenzy emergence of multicellular life, the chaos of the first snowball Earth event, the planet relished the opportunity to take a breather. The climate was constant, life appeared to be evolving very slowly, if at all, and oxygen remained at low levels. Little wonder the geologists have been calling this the boring billion. There you go. So that's one snowball life. Now, are they saying that, when they're saying, after the frenzy emergence of multicellular life, so multicellular life began at 1.8 billion years ago and there was a cap. Well, that's a bit hard to understand. So it's 1.8 billion years ago. Some think the name is a tad unfair. After all, this was when sexual reproduction first evolved, in that 1 billion years, and when the first eukaryotic organisms with complex cells of ultimately gave rise to ourselves appeared, which is a big deal. So I'm sure that 1,800 to 800 million years ago was just when eukaryotic cells came along, but I'm wrong. Eukaryotes, this is cells with a nucleus, organs with complex cells that ultimately gave rise to ourselves appear, quote, which is a big deal, says Nick Butterfield at the University of Cambridge. From the perspective of an alien Galileo space probe, however, little would appear to change. By the time the boring billion entered, life was really stepping up the accelerator pedal. At this time, called the Phanerozoic, the diversity of life forms skyrocketed in what was known as the Cambrian explosion. Oxygen finally reached levels that would be remotely detectable, and plants began to flourish on the planet's surface. So you can't get a plant, you know, even though it's hard to believe it, a plant needs available oxygen to react with its sugar. This is when the red edge would have been first visible. This complicated history offers a stark lesson for those hunting exoplanets based on Earth's current disappearance. Quote, for about 4/5 of Earth's history, we would not be able to see evidence of life on the surface, says Reinhard. Whether searching for high oxygen levels, oxygen-methane coexistence, or a red edge, you most probably would come up empty-handed. Quote, the obvious candidates for biosignatures aren't going to work well as we thought, said Olson. Part of the problem is how little we know about early Earth. It's no exaggeration to say, in some ways, we will soon know more about planets billions of kilometers away than we do about our own world billions of years into past. With so little surviving evidence, each piece is open to interpretation. Reconstructing Earth's history is a major challenge. Until the gaps are filled, what life-hunting astronomers need is a broad brush way of figuring out which planets to investigate further. Frederic Pallet of the Institute of Astrophysics of the Canary Islands, one promising avenue is the ancient equivalent of red edge. Ever since the days of Archaean, long before the continents became hotbeds for vegetation, so-called green beds, I would have said, or plant beds, garden beds, but they were probably swamped by purple mats of single-cell bacteria. Yeah, we were actually purple. If these tiny organisms were present in great enough numbers, said Pallet, their effect on light reflected from the Earth was similar to that of vegetation, but shifted towards the far red end of the spectrum. You can envision a whole bunch of colours you can get, says Abel Mendez, director of the Planetary Habitability Lab in Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico, depending on which bacteria are the most common. Yeah, so the Earth was originally purple. Because it was purple. It was purple because it was using the green. So plants evolved around it, which don't use the green. So green's the most efficient colour, but we're not using it at the moment. Now, try and figure that out. Attractive as though it sounds, its signal could be weak and tough to spot from afar. Olson and her colleagues think they have identified two more promising avenues. The first could be to observe planets over a long period, instead of just getting a snapshot of the atmosphere's composition. Observing Earth in this way, for example, would reveal a seasonal change in atmospheric carbon dioxide level. And that is because plants use more carbon dioxide during their growing season, and we have greater amounts of plants in the Northern Hemisphere, because there's a greater amount of plants there. Okay. This is because plants use more with the Northern Hemisphere dominating the effect because of its greater landmass. Oh, sorry for saying that. You see that kind of wobbly up and down once a year. On plant-free planets like the Praezoic Earth, it's not likely that photosynthesis microbes would be enough to cause clear oscillations in the carbon dioxide levels. Instead, respiring organisms must produce a similar seasonal variation in oxygen. And although oxygen levels themselves might be too low to spot from afar, the effect of fluctuations of the levels of other chemicals, such as ozone, could be conceivably picked up. One downside of using seasonality as a biosignature is that some worlds don't have seasons. Mendes points out that some planets around smaller diameter stars as Earth's closest neighbors must orbit close to the star and potentially be habitable. But doing so means they tend to end up keeping the same face pointed towards their star all the time. Quote, it's tightly locked, he says, so you don't have any seasons. Delicate imbalance. The other idea Olson and her colleagues are working on could prove to be more fruitful. It involves rethinking of how life might influence the makeup of the atmosphere. Much as methane and oxygen would not persist together on Earth if all present-day life disappeared, there are other combinations of gases that scientists regard as being in this equilibrium, that is, they would be hard to sustain without life. During the Archean, for example, such an imbalance of atmosphere, methane and carbon dioxide, nitrogen and water, that would have been rapidly wiped out as soon as it stopped being produced. But it isn't necessary to look for all those gases at once. Olson's team argue that you need only to see carbon dioxide and sufficiently large amounts of methane together in atmosphere to realize something biologically is probably afoot. And although the relative abundance of oxygen and methane would probably not have been measurable from afar at any point in the Earth's history, that carbon dioxide and methane might be. Quote, a detectable carbon dioxide and methane disequilibrium is more likely on a broader range of planets, says Olson, including those with undetectable levels of oxygen. Butterfield thinks looking for these atmospheric imbalances, looking for these atmospheric imbalances is an interesting idea, but cautions against falling for alien life as the explanation. Just seeing disequilibrium isn't interesting. It is interesting, he says, but it doesn't necessarily mean to be biological activity. Although false positives are inevitable, Olson is hopeful that clues like disequilibrium and seasonality will help fill in some of those blind spots in our search for life. For something, says Olson, quote, they are not tied to specific metabolisms. Alien life wouldn't be necessarily need to be like us or even be carbon-based for the potential biosignatures to reveal its existence on a distant planet. If you're looking at carbon dioxide and methane, my friend, it's pretty carbon-based. Getting a good enough look to find out, however, isn't going to be easy. Figuring out what's going on in the atmosphere of an exoplanet means gathering as much light as possible from it. But, of course, planets don't produce life, so they only reflect it, and that signal is dwarfed by the light of their star. To separate them, we need an enormous telescope like NASA's James Webb Telescope, which is only infrared, due to be launched in 2021. It's supposed to be launched last year, or this year, many years ago, or next generations of extremely large ground-based telescopes. Even with these devices, the task will be tricky. Seasonality on exoplanets will require so much telescope time, says Fellow, that we will not be able to measure that, and not as long as you and I are alive. No single measurement is ever going to be conclusive. By looking at the makeup of the planet's atmosphere, how it changes over time, and anything unusual that appears to be going on the surface, researchers will instead build a slowly evolving picture of that world's chances of hosting life. Quote, it's not going to be like a discovery that where you dig something up and say, hey, that's it, I found it, says Pelé. It's a process where we slowly choosing our best candidate. Our continued ignorance of aspects of the Earth's primordial past could also hamper the hunt for distant life. What set off the snowball Earths of the Protozoic, and, for example, is still a mystery. Even if we spot an exoplanet in an ice age, says Ron Hudd, we won't know how to interpret what we see. One of the biggest discoveries in history could elude us once again. Oh, well. That very last sentence really didn't link into me. Culture, which is book reviews. Among Cruel Stars, China's leading sci-fi author Xing Liu tells Ivan Yi that the future is bright for our species, partly because we kill everything in our path. Oh dear. Your Three Body Problem trilogy, first published in 2006 and 2010, describes the 20 million year long fallout from humanity's attempt to make contact with the extraterrestrial, how we well prepared we are for the arrival of an alien race like the Trisolarians. we're totally not ready yet. This is the Xin Lu, the author, says, we're totally not ready yet. The technology we have is still primitive. If other civilizations visit the aliens who are able to travel distance of hundreds or even millions of light years to get here, the gap between our respective technologies would be about the same as between humans and ants. How will a group of such highly civilizations ever know that we are intelligent? Actually, the problem works in both ways. What does an ant wandering across your desk know how you are the planet's dominant species? You do not know how to dig a hole. You do not fondle delicious dead bugs. You don't find, you don't protect your queen. All you do is hit those square-shaped things in front of you, an activity that generates absolutely no food whatsoever. Ants don't think your humans are intelligent at all. In the dark forest, this is Ivan Yi, asks the author. In the dark forest, in the middle volume of your trilogy, you wrote, quote, each civilization's goal is survival. This sounds like a Darwinian process applied to civilizationalists. Is it possible to have a galactic ecosystem that's ethical? The answer. First, we haven't discovered any extraterrestrial life form, not to mention any other civilization. And if we are to picture what the universe would be like if we were an enormous number of civilizations out there, we can only derive assumptions from our own experience. A glance over human history tells us the rise and fall of a great many civilizations is a result of war. It is even more depressing when we think about interspecies interactions. What happens when a species meets a stronger, more intellectually developed competitor? And that thought gives me shudders. The Cretaceous Paleogene extinctions was a horrible event. Dinosaurs and many other animals and plants were killed. But consider what we're witnessing now. Every year, thousands of species disappear because they ran up against humans. So the survival theory in the dark forest is reasonable. There could be a highly civilized cosmic ecosystems with high moral standards, but I think the possibility is low, given what we know about Earth's history. Next question. If we receive a message from the stars, should we respond? How to respond will be a decision of the entire world. We would need a consensus, as this should affect every one of us. I think we should be cautious rather than recklessly respond to a message to expose our location. We should simply don't know whether we are talking to friends or enemies. Some people think that if a species enjoys a high level of civilization, it's bound to maintain high moral standards. This is very naive. We have no way of knowing whether that is true. Most of your stories have sad endings. Are you pessimistic about the development of civilization? I'm absolutely positive about human survival. We will continue to develop our civilization and expand not just on Earth, but across the solar system. Oh dear. The galaxy and even the entire universe. God, help me. God, I don't know if you understand the distance involved. But I'm absolutely pessimistic about the survival of the other species who currently share the Earth with us. The development of human civilization will eventually force other living things to go extinct or become our food. Are you concerned that the destruction of the Earth ecosystems will threaten human survival? We're almost wholly reliant on science and technology for survival already. We can create an environment to sustain ourselves with technology, even if the ecosystems collapse. The new system could be on Earth or in space. We might develop one system or hundreds of them. Frankly, these environments could probably only support humans, although we probably wouldn't care about other species anyway. Humans are selfish, and because our innate selfishness, I'm very confident that we can overcome any amount of environmental destruction. Dear, can we work together as a civilization to develop, as civilization develops further? In the future? I believe we can work together. Even though we still have defined nations, each nation pursues its own interests. The border lines between nations, ethnicity and religions are disappearing. Technology is improving communication and accelerating cultural exchange. So I think the concept of nationhood will eventually vanish. The world will share the same set of values and become a more united group. The science in your stories is very detailed. Do you consult experts for plausibility when you write? I have never checked with any experts for my novels. Not long ago, science fiction was a very marginal activity and science fiction writers didn't have access to expert opinions. Those ideas and concepts of mine are all distilled from my own thought, self-taught understanding of science. When you write stories, this is the next question. Do you let your imagination fly free, or is there a limit to how far they can travel? The imagination in science fiction has boundaries. Unlike fantasy, science fiction must follow natural laws and scientific rules. For example, if you want to fly, you need a massive amount of energy to work against gravity. Writing a magical broom doesn't work like in science fiction. But there's something paradoxical about science and science fiction. Although it sets boundaries, science doesn't restrain our imagination. It only spurs it. What modern physics has revealed goes far beyond common sense. We zoom out, and the universe in science fiction is 40 billion light years across. That's 94 billion light years across, consisting of millions of solar systems and countless planets. No, billions of solar systems. Trillions. If we zoom in, the quantum mechanics inspires us to create a world that we can hardly visualize. Science immensity expands the canvas of science fiction. Fantasy, on the other hand, operates almost entirely at one human scale. Does it bother you that your wife and daughter don't like science fiction? Not at all. It's understandable they don't like it. Science fiction, whatever it comes from, has always been a niche genre, only enjoyed by a unique group of people. I write science fiction, not because I'm fond of the literature, because I'm fascinated by science. Which area of science excites you the most? I'm interested in studies that probe the mysteries of the nature of the universe, such as physics and cosmology. I spend a lot of my time every day reading about them and following the latest news. Do you think science fiction can predict the future? I don't think science fiction predicts the future at all. It simply lays out some possibilities. The 2018 we are living in now is so very different from the 2018 I wrote about in my short story of that name. Back when I wrote 2018, that year seemed really, really far away. But here we are. That's a interview with a person, another book review, I think it would be at this stage. No, this culture. Ceramic art acts as cunning foil for a collection of scientific curios, finds Simon Ings. Okay, this is ceramic art. So basically when we were teaching we had to produce ceramic models. Surreal Science, Loudon collection with Salvador Arancho. It's at Whitechapel Gallery in London. So this is a basically of scientific models. Whenever the artist Salvatore Arancho visits a new city, he heads for the nearest natural history museum. He goes partly for research. His eclectic output spanning photography and ceramics explores how we categorize and try to understand natural geological processes. So I think he's producing this as homage to it. In the main, although, Arancho wants to be overwhelmed. Quote, a lot of the collections are so vast that after a while you find yourself wandering around in a spaced out state, inventing mental landscapes and narratives. It's like that feeling I'm trying to evoke here, he tells me as we watch the assembly of his new show. Surreal Science, a collaboration with the art patron George Loudon. Loudon famously collected works by Damien Hirst and his generation years before they became global celebrities, until the days a canvas he bought wouldn't fit through the door. At this point, Loudon turned to books, images and models. In clay, felt, glass and plaster that educated the 19th century science students. Quote, looking back, I can see the move was a natural one, Loudon says. Artists like Hirst and Mark Dunant were exploring the way we catalogue and represent the world. Around the time that the collection felt complete, I was travelling to South America a lot, and I became interested in the scientific discoveries made there by Charles Darwin, Alexander von Humboldt, and Alfred Russel Wallace, and Henry Walter Bates. I don't know, Wallace went to South America. This is my health speaking. This isn't a collection in the sense that there are any demarcations of it, quote. It's somebody's personal eye that chooses over that, says Loudon. Nevertheless, it's a clear theme has emerged, how the explosion of science in the 19th century meant that scientists had to turn to artists to produce educational material for science students. And, when the burden became too much, how companies of artisans emerged to satisfy demand. Loudon's collection has been shown before at Manchester Museum last year, but surreal science is a different enterprise. The objects are designed to be handled, exhibited here on open shelves, bring the visitor tantalizing close to the work in a very un-museum-like manner. My wife, who's blind, would love this. Needless to say, this makes for a nerve-wracking build. This is a moment of truth for Inco, who had to plan the installation come exhibition armed with only photographs of Loudon's collection and sheets of careful measurements. It is the first chance he's had to see his arrangement realized in situ. The ceramic pieces are created, provides a foil for the items of Loudon's collection. An arrangement of ceramic flowers above an anatomical cutaway of a torso suggests a mandrake-like marriage between vegetable and human. Next to the it is the disgusting juxtaposition of plaster models of teeth and wax copies of lemons. Models of cell division are easily mistaken for geodes. Again and again, Ranko's ceramic pieces, pool leaves, coral and tubular spider forms, mislead the eye, so we miscatalogue what we see. Quote, I tried to create pieces that carried George's objects off into some kind of fantastic realm, says Sarenko, even before key elements of the show are installed. Proper lighting, a looping educational film from 1935, an experimental soundtrack by the focus group. It is clear the experiment has succeeded. Oh my god, that sounds wacko. For Loudon, it is vindication of his decision to collect objects that until recently weren't recognized as fine art marker. He moves from shelf to shelf past exquisite black sheer glass slugs, felt fungi, and meticulously repaired elephant bird eggs. Now, these objects have lost their original purpose. We can look at them as objects of beauty, he says. I'm not claiming this is art forever. I'm saying it's art for today. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. That is a nice quote at the end. Oh. Sure, I feel I have left things here. Are we coming to letters? Oh. Letters. Producers pay, but to whom? From Daniel Hackett's London, UK, Fred Pearce reports how a lawsuit over climate change might bring justice along the lines of the polluter pays. But from where might the payee raise the fines? From taxes or from energy charges, no doubt. There is thus a risk of sending money in circles unless funds are all spent on preventive or at least remedial works. This could make the exercise of suing nearly pointless and could even bring the question of the whole idea of the value of money. There will be little progress until some system can be devised in which economies aren't pitted against each other. Until then, the environment will always be the loser because it has not been costed or is a common resource, as in the case of the atmosphere and the oceans with the capacity as a heat sink. When a true cost-benefit analysis of our lifestyle is calculated, we'll have to admit that we are out of our depth. Fatalism based on religion will have to be tackled, since humans are the only agency that could solve this. So bring on the court cases, but realise this is but an opening shot of a massive upheaval. I love that. This is beautifully put. Okay, from Ian Klein, Whitchurch, Hampshire, UK. Ica, sir, I bring good news and bad on methane. Ica Solvayne points to the importance of reducing methane emissions to combat climate change. I have good and bad news. Such methane is emitted by ruminant livestock. The good news is success of tests on methane-reducing effects of adding seaweed, Aspergillus taxifolius, to livestock food. The bad news is that there are signs of massive methane releases from previously frozen deposits. These could easily outweigh any reductions in emissions from human activities. I suspect the current mess is due to three major blunders. The first was the emphasis on setting targets to cut emissions instead of controlling the levels of greenhouse gases. Second, many measures that are essential if... conventional wisdom is correct. From reducing waste to developing alternative fossil fuels, cutting livestock impact, are sensible regardless of the effect of human activities on climate change, and would even would be even if the world were cooling. Instead of pursuing such a win-win option, effort was wasted bickering about whether it was human activities. Activity matters. Third, and particularly, nobody wanted to pay to address these concerns or have their consumer convenience affected. Neoliberal capitalism is a Ponzi scheme. So a Ponzi scheme is basically, I can get you make money by you giving me $10, and I, you know, two people give me $10 and I give you back $11. And just fall off the Ponzi scheme. Okay. I've really got to work out how this is. From London, John O'Hara, Mount Waverley, Victoria, Australia. Whatever value Earth Overshoot Day may have as a measure of the rate at which we are trashing the planet, Malthus Wackenagel is on the money and describing typically economic activity as the largest Ponzi scheme. The dominant global paradigm is the developed world is neoliberal capitalism. It ticks four boxes recognized as defining a Ponzi scheme. It is predicated on infinite growth, which is impossible in the finite world. And when the growth stops, it falls over. There's no way of softening the landing, and the precise point of collapse can't be predicted. The reason this description hasn't been registered in mass consciousness is the longest time span to collapse. I like that. On the same topic, Fred White, Nottingham, UK. A society determines actions based on constant figures for their profit potential at all scales, from the household up to government levels, and should work, but these actions are based on economic systems that draws down capital assets and counts them as profits. It assumes continual growth is possible on a finite system and takes no account of cleaning up the consequences of the action. Our descendants will be at a loss to know how society capable of exploring other planets and editing the genome could possibly have done so without a counting system that encourages 2 plus 2 equals 7. I like that one. That's a beautiful letter, because it ends in a very good way. When glaciers have gone, it's too late to use valleys. By Perry Pemberlington, Kimberley, North Hampshire. Eric Foxcroft suggests using vacant glacier valleys as water reservoirs for pump storage hydropower. By the time glaciers have retreated to make this viable, I think it'll be a bit too late. So I think to think about a storage. Renewable energy thwarted by appliances. By Ian Smith of Linton, Cambridge, UK. Paul Whitney suggests that instead of funding large-scale energy projects, we should spend money putting solar hot water panels on people's roofs. We have solar hot water panels on our roof and have saved the monies for some years. But our predominant use of warm water is to wash clothes. Needing a new washing machine, we couldn't find one that took warm water from the system, only ones that took cold water and then heated. The rise in our electricity bills has been significant. Meanwhile, we have excess hot water and it can get very hot. Any generation must be accompanied by appliances that enable resulting heat to be used in the most practical way. Thank you for your interesting article on allergies. What is the role of stress in producing allergies? I was amazed, though, to find out no discussion of whether stress levels have a role, either as a precursor to allergic reactions or exacerbating them. On the same topic, Penny Cook from County Durham, or Tony Kelly from Crook, County Durham. Penny such as doesn't mention a factor that I'm sure contributes to allergies, stress. I prefer unrelenting mental stress to which there is no conceivable ending or solution. I'm sure, for example, that at least some children who develop an allergy after starting school are targets of bullying. In Australia, they keep cats under curfew. Ulrich Craig, Washington Borough, Lincolnshire, UK. Lord Hugh Boyd complains that farming is blamed for wildlife lows and mentions that domestic cats kill vast numbers of birds. In some areas of Australia, there are curfews for cats. In contrast, to the strange UK policy of allowing them to roam anywhere at any time. Aboriginal communities have found that feral cats, blamed for driving up to 30 species to extinctions, are a great source of food, and that is true. Cats, they just love eating those cats. I was surprised to read, this is Terraforming Mars in the style of science fiction, by Byrne Glover, Kirby Malzard, North Yorkshire. These little villages, no doubt. I was surprised to read that, quote, we, whoever that might be, have never dreamed of converting Mars into an Earth-like world. No one, surely, has ever proposed this as a practical possibility outside the realms of science fiction, have they? Quote. Future geologists will define the Anthropocene. While International Union of Geological Sciences, IUGS, has declared that we are still in the Holocene epoch, I believe the Anthropocene is functionally and stratigraphically different from the Holocene. When did it start, and what evidence is appropriate to distinguish the two? The idea that a layer of plastic rubbish is a marker is likely to be appropriate, because over many millennia, rock starters are reworked vertically and laterally. Perhaps, though, the result will be a brand of plastoglomerate lithic material that will serve as a new world watermarker. Maybe the growth of radionuclides in the sediments accumulated since the 20th century will provide a uniform marker. The priority of the IUGS may be in the nomenclature defining eras, periods, epochs, and ages. But it needs to acknowledge the impact of a species on the geological record or not. Mark Masson of Simon Lewis Intimate go out of its way to confuse members of the public. I don't know why I'm confused by reading that. My job has already fallen to digital technology. From Alistair Blotcher in London, UK. Your articles on the rules that robots should follow contains the platitude, quote, "We must be careful. It's only employers that benefit from robots. It isn't only the employers. As one of many of those professions that have already been digitally destroyed, I'm tired of this feeble plea. For 2 years, I've painted backdrops in theatres. Now, all middle-skilled work in the field is done by large-scale digital printing. There isn't enough high-skilled work to support the infrastructure for training and career progression. So we see the end of a profession that dates back to the Renaissance. The owners of this technology have now all our jobs, but progress is not incremental or accidental. There is no way I or my colleagues can get the originators or the owners of this technology to share the benefits, nor those who should perhaps be described as the unemployers. Nor will this change. How can it? All the benefits accrue to those who control the technology. Digital technology tends to promote the most rampageous form of capitalism yet seen. Relying on votes from unsustainable farmers. By Jeff Brown, Sydney, Australia. Chris Milligan warns that much of the world is in for a rough ride from climate change. It's timely given the drought gripping New South Wales, as I write. What isn't timely is the response to the Australian government. As usual, it's dispensing vast amount of drought relief, quote-unquote, cash, without consideration of whether changing climate is making this largest misplace. How many farms are really viable in the new climate world? Has any research been done to establish the viability of raising hoofed animals on soils that are drying and deteriorating? Of course, the current government depends on farmers' parties to stay in office. Okay, and this is last word. A question from the authors is, I've just read that eggs should not be stored in the rack above on the fridge door, the exact place where the fridge manufacturers put egg racks. Before I revamp my fridge, is there any truth in this? And if so, what could it be? Once an unfertilized egg drops out of the back of a chicken, or out of its, what, a clacker or something, it crosses the road towards decay. I love that. Isn't that a beautiful sentence? It crosses, what did the chicken say? Where did the chicken cross the road? That's because the chicken embryos indeed need to breathe, so the egg must be gas permeable. Even to the absence of an embryo, carbon dioxide diffuses out through the shell, and this makes the interior less acidic. Water from the white or albumen also diffuses outwards, and so by osmosis to the yolk. Okay. The egg white thus becomes inhospitable to healthy proteins, which have naturally folded structure that depends on local acidity. Now, this in turn swells the yolk and makes the membrane more fragile. If you ever try to make a souffle using old eggs, you'll find out the whites and yolks have become inseparable. All this process speeds up with temperature, so storing eggs in a fridge is a good start. But an open rack behind the door is not the best spot. You know, when you open the fridge, you waft fresh, warm air over any layer of carbon dioxide that has built up in the egg's surface. This encourages yet more diffusion out of the egg, and yet more aging. So just best to actually store it in carbon dioxide is a big question. You also tend to shake the eggs, resulting in more watery albumen by mixing thick and thin components of the white. The best place in the fridge to store eggs is probably in a sealed box to prevent diffusion and low down as possible. In other words, in the coolest part, this slows the loss of carbon dioxide and water of the air and also prevents the egg from taking up odours from inside the fridge. It's worth remembering that eggs emerge from a contaminated parts of the bird's anatomy. So routinely have bacteria, notably Salmonella enteritis. A sealed box would stop egg winds wafting over other contents of the fridge. You should also clean the egg regularly, whatever the fridge, wherever in the fridge it may be. Okay, so that's the point that the eggs are not contaminated. I wonder if fridge makers originally put the egg racks inside the doors because they could not think what else to use these tiny spaces for. And this is a German, Simon Goldman from Gruchten, Germany. Eggs can be stored in the fridge, preferably in a box, in slow water loss. But they should be taken out and allowed to reach room temperature before cooking. This is important if you like a soft yolk. Herbs en cocotte, the eggs sunny side up, won't work otherwise because when the white is cooked, the yolk is still only lukewarm. I've learnt back in the 60s that when working a short order chef at a motorway service where I learnt to crack eggs single-handedly. I like that a little bit. I love that thing. There's a bit of advice and then a bit of advice going after. So I should learn to that. I should give advice and then say, oh, by the way, I've done some quantum physics in my life. Okay. And we're 51 minutes in. Every so often, my adopted cat brings home the geckos in two pieces. This adopted cat. Namely, still moving tail and the rest of the body is also still moving, but there's never any obvious signs of blood. Why? Wild animals must recover from severe injuries or die. Where we live, I'm repeatedly amazed to see game birds survive incidental injuries and regain normal use of loosely flapping broken legs or wings that have been crooked. The realities of natural selection are so extreme that many snakes, insects, fish, birds, and developed highly effective self-healing abilities. As a result, they can afford to try and redirect attacks towards the non-critical areas at their rear. In particular, frills of hair, loosely set feathers, fake heads, or indeed sacrificial tails. Some animals even use their tails non-sacrificially to attract prey. Many lizards have more or less fragile tails that distract predators by thrashing when they're broken off. If alarmed, some geckos drop their tail whether or not something is tucking at it. An example of that is known as autotomy, self-cutting. A tail is a major investment served by its own artery. Letting it bleed would be fatal, so muscles at intervals along the blood vessels clamp the throat and blood clots rapidly. It's something surgeons can only envy. Another answer. So that's one from South Africa. This is from France. Many lizards and geckos display this behavior, which is known as autotomy. So it's nice that they've actually put this across. Where I live, there is no geckos, but lots of water lizards, which silted around the guard Shalom. Occasionally, just moving one of my outside bins will reveal a wiggling tail that started lizard having made off. My cat loves hunting lizards and has brought in tails, although less often now, but never both the tails and its owner together. Lizards do grow a new tail, but it lacks a vertebrae and clearly doesn't match the rest of the body. And this is from, I'm going to put a Yank accent, but this is from Oregon. Stephen Johnson, for exchange term. In Hawaii, I see geckos hunted by cattle egrets. Both are invasive species here. The egret walks on top of the hedge and reaches down to grab the geckos, which they, with their beak. If one gets hold of the tail, I frequently see the gecko fall away, leaving the egret with only a tail in its mouth. If it grabs the body, the egret must still twist the gecko 90 degrees to swallow it, and so many still wind up with just the tail. Thank you. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.